Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
I learned the hard way that the communication in this arena is absolutely vital. It's really important because we're in such a limited time frame to get this message across effectively.
If we can say, hey, here's a way we can stabilize a climate where we boost the world economy rather than cripple the world economy, you won't have to have politicians pass laws. If people see a strong economic motivation to stabilize the climate, they'll do it tomorrow. And frankly, I think we need to do it tomorrow.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to the show that gets you thinking, talking, maybe even doing something too, because climate change is the subject today as COP26 continues. I'll introduce my guests shortly. Thanks for the feedback to last week's C.S. Lewis movie show, by the way, and excited to be able to announce some fresh theatrical release dates in the US and UK that Max McLean has sent me. So I'll give you that towards the end of the show, along with this week's feedback. For more from the show, go to our show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. That includes links to our video channel, our newsletter, our Confident Christianity course, which we're extending the discount on for the whole of November, and ways to support the show as well. For now, let's leap into today's very timely discussion. Well, today we're asking, what does the science of climate change tell us about the future of the world? COP26, the UN Climate Change Conference, is underway in Glasgow. And in recent years, the predictions around climate change have become increasingly apocalyptic. And the most recent IPCC report warns that we are approaching a tipping point and that greenhouse gas emissions must be reduced to net zero by 2050 for a climate crisis to be averted. Now, while activist groups like Extinction Rebellion are becoming ever more extreme in some ways in their protests, other so-called lukewarmers believe that there's too much alarmism among climate change activists, that the picture isn't necessarily as bleak as painted. So what does the science of climate change actually say? What constitutes a reasonable and ultimately Christian approach to tackling it? Hugh Ross and Antonia Godber join me to talk it through on today's show. Hugh Ross is the founder of the Faith and Science Ministry, Reasons to Believe. He's an astrophysicist by background. And his recent book, Weathering Climate Change, says that the Earth has been in an unusually long period of climate stability. And he looks at the data for recent climate change, advocating for a non-alarmist approach to providing practical solutions. Antonia Godber is a climate change campaigner who's passionate about encouraging sustainable and ethical lifestyles to ensure future generations can inherit a healthy planet. And she'll also be contributing to an online COP26 coalition event this weekend, actually, on how to talk to kids and parents about climate. That's in conjunction with Parents for Future, who she's working with. And we'll make sure there are links to both Antonia and Hugh with the show today, and I'll mention them later on as well. So Antonia and Hugh, welcome along to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to have you both with me. Antonia, we'll start with you as someone who's new to the show, though we've known each other, as I've mentioned on a previous Unbelievable show, as childhood friends. And we recently came into each other's orbit again through Instagram. And you very kindly accepted this invitation to come on the show, having listened for a little while. Tell us a bit about your background. You are a doula. Explain what that is and where your own activism for climate change and ethical campaigning came from.
Okay. Well, first of all, huge thanks for having me on. It's a massive honour. It's lovely to see you and meet you, Hugh. A doula, lots of people actually know what a doula is. It's an ancient word which means woman servant, essentially. So my job is to take care of parents throughout their pregnancy and during their entire birth experience, however that ends up being, whatever happens. And then as well, taking care of them in the postnatal period back at home with their baby as they get to know their new child and adjust to their new normal. Because I think, you know, motherhood is incredibly difficult, especially in our modern paced, fast life. So it's a wonderful role. I also do a lot of birth work. So lots and lots of classes, teaching, pregnancy, birth, obviously breastfeeding, but now more so focusing actually on helping parents who are actually very worried about climate change. It's becoming an increasing need that I've noticed. And, you know, whereas my eco warrior classes that I call them, spelt with an O for people who are worried, whereas those classes were sort of, you know, three or four people would turn up a year ago. Now, you know, I'm getting many, many more people who need that sort of group support. So that's my professional role.
Right. And to what extent, you know, have your own sort of concerns grown in recent years around climate change? Is this something you've always been passionate about? Has it really become a central feature of your thinking recently?
Well, actually, you know, there are sometimes, I think, in a person's life, moments that can really change everything. And I very vividly remember feeding my third baby one night, middle of the night, reading an article about a refugee family who had been on one of those dinghy boats. And the father had, he described how the boat had tipped over and his little child had been torn away from his arms in the water. And I looked down at my baby girl, who was identical age, and I just remember feeling absolutely desolate. And that, you know, the next morning I said to my husband, we've got to do something. And that led to my life changing quite radically. And although I continued with my birth work, which I absolutely love, I engaged my local community in getting to help me pull together a lot of resources and money. And over the next 2 years, we took all those things to various refugee camps, namely the one in Calais in France. And we visited and spoke with those refugees living in terrible conditions there and heard their stories. And then I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years after that refugee camp had sort of been set up, it was razed to the ground by the French authorities. And it felt like all our efforts had sort of come to nothing. And so from there, I started to look at the origins of this crisis and why these people were ending up suffering in this way. And ultimately, led me to find out much more about the climate crisis. I mean, we imagine these people are mainly fleeing war and violence, which a lot of them are. But a lot of these people are fleeing uninhabitable lands. You know, Syria began because of a drought. The war in Syria was massively inflamed because of climate. And I started to realise that this refugee crisis that we were, you know, in, it was only going to get a lot worse. And in fact, you know, if predictions came true and we were looking at, you know, a billion climate refugees, displaced people by 2050, then I realized that it would make this sort of Calais refugee camp, you know, look like Disneyland, really. So I started to focus all my attention on climate activism, initially with Extinction Rebellion, actually, and then, as I said, with Parents of the Future.
Okay, well, we'll talk maybe a little bit later about Extinction Rebellion. We'll introduce Hugh, though. Hugh may be familiar to some listeners and viewers. You've been on the show several times before, Hugh. Tell us a little bit about this recent book, though, Weathering Climate Change. What made you want to particularly pick up your pen and write on this particular issue?
Well, a lot of books have been written on climate change, but what I was noticing is that the physical sciences were not being brought to play. So as an astrophysicist, I said, you know, something needs to be said about the fact that we've been in an ice age cycle for 2.58 million years. That ice age cycle actually makes possible our global civilization. And yet the really interesting thing is for the last 9,500 years, we've had extreme climate stability. And we don't see that in the ice age cycle. The entire ice age cycle is characterized by really radical climate instability, We're talking the global mean temperature jumping up and down by 8 degrees centigrade over timescales of just two or three centuries. And yet, you know, why have we had these 9,500 years? And the latest temperature data tells us that the climate is about four times more stable than what we thought 5 years ago. The global mean temperature has been stable to within 0.65 degrees centigrade for the past 9,500 years. And so a lot of the debate where people bring up, say, the Middle Age warming or the little ice age, the latest temperature data tells us that those temperature excursions have been overestimated by about a factor of two. And therefore, the greatest temperature excursion we're seeing over the past 9,500 years is what we've witnessed over the past 70. And I think I share the concern that, you know, if that trend continues, we're going to see a repeat of what we've seen in the Ice Age cycle, namely that global warming about 2 degrees centigrade beyond where we are right now brings on severe global cooling.
Your view is that it will actually result in a cooling effect ultimately. So just explain why that is, Hugh.
Well, what we've seen in the previous Ice Age cycles is that the global mean temperature goes about 2 to 3 degrees centigrade above where we are right now. And that amount of warming will melt the winter polar ice, not just the summer polar ice, but the winter polar ice. And when that happens, instead of sunlight being reflected by 60% efficiency off of polar ice, it's now reflected with only 6% efficiency. So what happens to all that extra solar radiation? It gets absorbed by the open Arctic Ocean water. It forms water vapor, and that water vapor will fall as snow on Siberia and Canada. I mean, Siberia and Canada are plenty cold enough today to bring on an ice age. The reason that's not happening is that they're virtual deserts. So as long as the precipitation level is low over most of Canada and Siberia, we're okay. But if you melt the polar ice cap, that could easily double or triple the snowfall over Siberia and Canada. And previous ice ages show us that the sign is you begin to see snow accumulating in western Siberia, followed by snow accumulating in Labrador. And when that happens, you know that an ice age is going to come upon the Earth very quickly. And with that, you're going to get really extreme climate instability. So I think I'm with your guest in the sense we need to make sure we don't melt the winter polar ice cap. That would be catastrophic, far greater than any of the scenarios we're seeing with the global warming prognostications.
That's very interesting. Have you come across this sort of particular perspective, Antonio? Because you don't often hear about climate change leading to an ice age, actually. This is obviously the key thing Hugh thinks we ought to be worried about in the long run.
Yeah, and actually, Hugh, I downloaded and reading your book, which I am very much enjoying. And it was quite new information to me because, you know, we understand the language, don't we, global warming and the Earth getting hotter. But from what I understand, and I'm no astrophysicist, I think I only learned to spell that last week. But from my understanding that, you know, any way you look at it, 2 degrees is terribly bad news because interesting to hear you say about the absorbed, the sun being absorbed and then that causing snow. In my research, I've looked more into the blue ocean events where, of course, when the ice melts, the sun is a bit like when you're wearing a black jumper on a hot day and you regret it because the sun suddenly feel very hot because the sun shines on your black top and you feel very warm. When the ice is gone, then the ocean, the blue ocean underneath the dark colour suddenly absorbs this great amount of sunlight, which was previously reflected by the snow. And then, of course, it leads to runaway climate change. And obviously, Hugh knows a great more than I do about what that runaway climate change entails. But I think for me, as a, you know, a mum and an activist, my understanding is that essentially it's incredibly bad news and something to be avoided at all costs.
Well, I mean, another consequence is that if you've got a lot of melting polar ice, that turns back the Gulf Stream, and that's right. Going to make Britain and Norway much, much colder than they are right now. So, people are looking at the warming. We need to be really examining the climate instability. That's the major risk we're facing.
I suppose global warming as a phrase could be quite misleading, couldn't it? Instability is probably a better way to describe it.
I mean, you say, Hugh, that we've been in this sort of period of unprecedented climate stability up till now. Why do you think that is? You say that it's meant that human civilization has essentially been able to develop to the degree it has, that there simply wasn't the time for that to happen in between previous ice ages. What do you account for this particular age of stability that we've been in thus far?
Well, what's unique about the ice age cycle we're in right now is that a major asteroid struck in northwest Greenland, and that brought out what's called the Younger Dryas cooling event, where the global mean temperature dropped by 8 to 10 degrees centigrade for a 1,200-year period. What that did is it prevented the global mean temperature from going up to its normal maximum. I mean, variations in the tilt of Earth's rotation axis and variation in the shape of Earth's orbit are what's driving the ice age cycle. So, for example, when the tilt drops down towards 24 degrees, that warms the planet. When it goes up to 22 degrees, that cools the planet. When the orbit becomes more circular, that cools the planet. But right now, both of those cycles are dramatically cooling the planet. So we've been in a natural cooling phase for the past 8,700 years. Now, what has sustained the climate stability is that when the natural cycles went from warming the planet to cooling the planet, there was, thanks to this asteroid collision, it stabilized the climate for a short period of time, just a short period of time, but that launched what's called the Neolithic Revolution, where humans began to build towns, they were trading, they were upgrading their agriculture, and all of this had a warming effect that counterbalanced the natural cooling. And if you actually look at the past 9,500 years, from 8,700 years ago until about 1950, human activity was not quite keeping pace with the natural cooling. And so there's been a 1 degree centigrade decline in the global mean temperature from 8,700 years ago until 1950. But what's happened since the end of World War II, human activity has accelerated. And accelerated where now the human activity is outstripping the natural warming. So in the past 70 years, the climate has warmed by 1 degree centigrade. We're right back where we were 8,700 years ago. Now, that's not cause for alarm. We can handle a 1 degree, but we can't handle another degree. One more degree, I think, is going to have a dramatic impact on the winter snowpack. And now we're looking, people are worried about rising sea levels. We actually need to be concerned about dropping sea levels. Because if you start packing a lot of ice over Siberia and Canada, you're going to see a significant drop in sea levels. But worse than that, once we see the warming switching over to cooling, you're going to get really unstable climate. And it's going to be worldwide. It's not just going to be North America and Europe. It's going to be a worldwide climate instability situation. And I would argue this is far worse than the global warming scenarios that are being painted by the alarmists. But you labeled me an anti-alarmist. I'm basically saying if we alarm people, they're going to wind up panicking, doing the wrong things, and bringing about unintended consequences. You know, in my book, I got two chapters on unintended consequences, where we think we're doing the right thing to stabilize the climate, and it actually makes things worse. And so if we can find ways to encourage people to take the steps, and basically I'm making the point, we need to understand that people and nations are fundamentally selfish. And so self-interest is a big factor. And we ask them to say, hey, you need to cut your standard of living by a factor of two, they're going to say, well, I'm going to let Joe do it. I'm not going to do it. But if we can say, hey, here's a way we can stabilize the climate where we boost the world economy rather than cripple the world economy, you won't have to have politicians pass laws. If people see a strong economic motivation to stabilize the climate, they'll do it tomorrow. And frankly, I think we need to do it tomorrow. If we wait 3 years, it's going to be too late. We need to get people doing something positive right away.
Okay. It's just very interesting. I'm finding it so interesting that the place you're coming at is not necessarily the place climate change activists always come from, but nonetheless, you see this is a very significant and probably worse problem, in fact, than many do. Antonia, from your perspective, what for you needs to happen? What are the recommendations, firstly, that are on the table from people like the IPCC, and what as far as you're concerned has to happen in order to avert this crisis going forward?
I think going back to Hugh's point, that he's right. Global warming and the warming itself and CO2 levels, that's just one very small part of this enormous jigsaw, which is actually quite complex. There's so much more to it than just the warming. There's so much more to it than just the CO2. You know, human beings have wiped out 60% of wildlife in the last 40 years. And that's just one of many devastating statistics. We have caused so much damage. And so when you think about species extinction, by the time we finish recording this, you know, countless extinction species will have gone extinct because it's happening so quickly. And the thing to remember here is that it's much bigger, as I said, than one aspect. And whilst we can do lots of things to sort of, you know, I say we, I mean politicians, I mean people in power, can do things to control global warming, if you like. Global warming is just one aspect. We've got to think about biodiversity loss, habitat loss. It all comes together in this phrase. I think climate change is quite a misleading phrase because people will say, well, the climate's always been changing, and it has. So now we need to start focusing on the phrase climate breakdown, because the systems are breaking down. Our life support systems are breaking down. Now, in terms of Hugh's point about alarmism, I 100% agree that alarm doesn't help. It's an emotion that makes us absolutely feel very panicky and running around like, you know, headless chickens. And I can assure you both, there was a stage in my life when I was not that fun at parties because I was alarmist. I was that sandwich board wearing chap, you know, the end is nigh. I was not fun. People don't like him. And I learned the hard way that communication in this arena is absolutely vital. It's really important because we're in such a limited time frame to get this message across effectively. And it's a very tricky balance. We don't want to sort of let people, people have been misled hugely, I believe, by the media as it is. They've been lulled into this false sense of security that it will all get sorted out. You know, they'll meet in Paris and sort it out, and they didn't. And they'll meet at COP26 and they'll sort it out. When really what we're hearing even today from Glasgow is a lot of shoulds and musts, but not a lot of we will. So I agree that we have to get the balance between not alarming people to an extent that they become paralysed, but also raising the awareness level. This is not something that's talked about. This isn't mentioned at the school gate. This isn't chatted about at parties. I was the doom and gloom girl for a while, and I've learned, I've had lots of support, and I've, in working with the movements I work with, we've worked and trained really hard on talking to people about this in a way that doesn't make them feel paralysed, but also gears them into action. So to answer your question about what should be done, well, an enormous amount. We are headed for, we're literally racing towards the edge of a cliff. If you imagine we're on an aeroplane, and the aeroplane is definitely going in a downhill. It's going to crash, and we really need to make the landing as smooth as possible, because of course every degree of warming that we can avoid, every species we can save, every area of forest that we can grow back, and every part of nature that we can heal will make a huge difference, not just to our lives but to animals and also future generations. And so it's absolutely worth trying. So what I tell people is, imagine we're on this plane and we've got a few people at the front of the plane knocking on the door to the pilot and saying, we've got to do something. And there's not many of us doing that. And then we've got some people at the back of the plane, you know, in the brace positions, too late, complete defeat, we're doomed. And they're sort of in the brace position, ready to crash. And a lot of other people on the plane are just eating peanuts and watching films, because the media hasn't made this You know, this should be on the news every night. This should be on buses. This should be what Hugh and I are talking about is the potential extinction of our species. And not the, the crime here is not just us and our children, but it's the huge injustice to people in the global south who have done the very least to cause this. Africa, I think, are responsible for about 4% of global emissions. Yet Africa is the most exposed continent to the effects. And as Hugh said, they're going to be varied. They're going to be all sorts of weather events. There's going to be food production will be disrupted, floods and everything else. And you know, you're the expert here in terms of what will happen, but we know it's going to be bad. And so to answer your question, what do we need to do? We need to wake people up. We need to shake people up. We know, not to the point of alarm and paralysis, but my job in when I work with parents, for example, is to energize them, to help them realize this is not their fault. Nobody wakes up in the morning hoping, you know, there'll be extra plastic in the supermarket and that their car will be extra dirty. Nobody wakes up intentionally wanting to harm the earth. And I would disagree with you that humans are inherently selfish. I don't believe that. I believe that humans are inherently very cooperative as a species. We're very kind and loving, but we're stuck in this capitalistic system of continued drive for more and more and more material things. And we've been misled to believe that that's essentially the answer to happiness. And I don't believe that it is.
Hugh, just before we go to a quick break, where do you stand on the IPCC trajectories and the sorts of solutions that they are advocating in order to reduce the warming?
Well, I meet a lot of people who are global warming deniers, and mainly they point out that the IPCC projections have not been quite fulfilled. And I point out, well, they were half right. I mean, yeah, if you drop it by a factor two, it's still something to worry about. Yes, there were overestimates. The new models are getting better. But I think the real reason why how to explain global warming deniers is they're saying what we're hearing from the politicians in the IPCC is that we need to all undergo draconian economic sacrifices. And they say that's just the government trying to control our lives. And so, I mean, you ask people, I mean, I've tried this with my sons. You know, would you be willing to cut your standard of living by a factor of two? And they joking and said, well, my friends would rather to see the planet go up in smoke than do that. And so I said, well, what if we could stabilize the climate where we actually get an economic benefit from it? And they said, we would sign up tomorrow. And so that's kind of what I'm saying in weathering climate change is if we can give people a positive economic incentive to stabilize the climate, I think that will eliminate all this global warming denying. I mean, when the pain is too great, people will dig in their heels and they'll say, I'm not going to do it. But if you can actually show them a more pleasant way to deal with the climate problem, then I think everybody's going to sign on.
We'll come back to this because it's an interesting factor that you've brought in there, you know, human inclination, you know, for selfishness, that's potentially getting in the way of them even being willing to hear, you know, a climate change message. We're talking about climate change today on the show. It is, of course, because COP26 is underway in Glasgow. And more than ever in recent years, the climate change issue has come to dominate our news feeds. And rightly so, it is a major issue in our day and age. Today on the show, Hugh Ross and Antonia Godber join me to discuss it. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. We're talking about climate change today. COP26 in Glasgow is underway. And, well, some people say that it's all a bit too alarmist. I have been hearing from a number of what's sometimes called lukewarmers, Antonia. And these are people who would say, well, look, yes, there is human-created climate change, but it's not as dramatic as is often painted. And that actually... there are even sometimes beneficial effects actually to a rise in temperatures. And I think people who feel like there's a sort of ideology at work here sometimes, almost religious in its fervour, they feel that this isn't actually a helpful way of talking through the issues, because people become so dogmatic and almost unable to respond reasonably almost to the issues at hand. What do you say to that? I mean, some of the well-known names in this area, people like Michael Schellenberger, Matt Ridley, who's a Lord in the House of Lords, and others who talking about a false alarm that actually this issue has been overblown. Where do you stand on that yourself, Antonia?
Well, I agree. I've heard from these people as well. And there's a few of them. And I think what we have to do is look at the motivations behind why they're saying what they're saying. Essentially, though, these people, the two chaps that you've mentioned happen to be journalists. Ridley's a businessman as well, a House of Lords, as you say. Ridley himself is very invested in coal. He lives on a plant where he lives very near a coal plant, and he's receiving a lot of money. He won't disclose how much, but he's receiving a lot of money every year from coal. Schellenberger as well, again, a journalist. I don't know about you, but if I break my leg, I want to see a doctor. If I get arrested, which was a risk with Extinction Rebellion, I need a lawyer. And if I want to understand climate science, I'm going to go to a climate scientist. I'm not going to listen to a journalist, especially one who's essentially invested in fossil fuels. What they're talking about has been so widely disputed by the science that it's just, it's almost laughable. The things that they've come up with, I think Schellenberger said that factory farming was a brilliant idea, and we could feed many, many people with GMO crops and things like that have been so widely disproven now that it's you have to look at the motivation behind why they're saying these things, essentially.
Well, to step in for Schellenberger, and I've only recently started listening a bit and reading some of his stuff, just wanted to see what the other side of the argument has been saying in this debate. Sure. And one of the points he made is that he feels that there is a problem on the climate change side, the climate change activism side, because they're unwilling to look at some of the most obvious ways in which CO2 could be released. So nuclear energy, that is often said, no, we can't possibly go in that direction. What do you think of that? Is that a problem for the
Well, I think it's just another controversy. It's another example of how we're sort of, squabbling amongst ourselves about the best solution. And essentially the argument between renewables and nuclear, they both got pros and cons. I mean, nothing is perfect. Essentially what we're trying to do is chase the lifestyle, as Hugh said, chase the lifestyle we've been used to, and not change our, standard of living by any level whatsoever, so that we can carry on as living as we are. And I think, if I could bring this back personally to my own experience of faith, I grew up in a very, very loving, very Christian home. And it was my faith was, I wholly accepted everything I was taught at Sunday school, up until my mother was diagnosed with leukemia. And she when she died, when I was 10, I started to, ask questions as 10-year-olds would. And that led me to sort of, throughout my teenage years and an on-off relationship with the church, really start to stop seeing God as this sort of sky God, Father Christmas type man in the sky, but more of a, immanential God, a God who lives and breathes in every atom of the earth and creation. And essentially that leads me to sort of ask you, I suppose, how can you accept that human beings are selfish and will not change when Christ himself, I mean, for me, my Christianity is incredibly straightforward and simple, and entirely focused around the Gospels and Jesus, who simply said, love your neighbour as you love yourself. Now, of course, 2000 years ago, your neighbour was literally your neighbour. And now we're a global community, and your neighbour, I mean, tug on one part of nature and you'll find it connected to all of nature. We're so connected. Coronavirus has taught us how connected we are. So how can we justify an attitude where we say, well, we're not willing to change anything about our lives, even though quite clearly in the West, our wealthy Western lifestyles are literally stealing from the poor. And how can we justify continuing that when Christ himself said to do the exact opposite?
Hmm. Hugh, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you look at Genesis and Job, we have God basically saying to humanity, I'm putting you in charge of the planet. Manage its resources for your benefit and the benefit of all other life. Now, that implies that God has designed our planet in such a way that we will find win-win solutions. Solutions that are going to benefit the world's ecosystems, solutions that will benefit us. And what I propose in my book, Weathering Climate Change, are these win-win solutions where we enhance the well-being of the world's ecosystems, bring the wildlife populations back, enhance the plant life on the planet, at the same time boost the world economy and especially boost it for the poorest people of the world. So in that sense, I think this is entirely in line with the message of Christianity.
It's a very human-centric view, isn't it? Going back to Genesis, as if the earth was a sort of present to humans. And I suppose that is a quite popular belief within Christianity. And I suppose I differ there in believing that as opposed to us having dominion over the earth, God-given dominion, I believe that we are just a part of the ecosystem itself. And
no, I'm not disagreeing. That was my point. God has put us in charge of managing this planet, not just for our benefit, but for the benefit of all other life on planet Earth. Plants, animals, bacteria, the whole shebang.
So, but in an economy where we are currently, we're literally, we need 1.5 Earths to continue, you know, it was a Global Footprint that recently said we're literally, it's like we're earning our salary every month and we're spending that and 50% more and we're getting into debt. So how can we, you know, continue to drive the economy without changing lifestyles at all?
Well, I'm advocating we change lifestyles, but change lifestyles in such a way that it actually brings an economic benefit to all the nations and peoples of the world, in which case it's going to be easy to get people to sign on. I mean, the point I'm making, if you're asking people to make a very big economic sacrifice, you're going to get a lot of resistance. But if you say these are things we can do that's going to benefit the world's ecosystems, it's going to improve human health, it's going to extend our lifespan, it's especially going to benefit the poorest people of the world. If you've got win-win-win solutions, why not bring them to bear?
I'd be interested in hearing some examples. Obviously, we don't have a lot of time to spell them out in detail, Hugh, but give us just a couple of what you think these could be, these win-win sort of solutions, which you think are more palatable ultimately than some of the more drastic solutions of Extinction Rebellion and co.
Yeah, and I'm thinking we need to look at solutions that we can institute right away, not 10, 20 years down the road, because that's where I agree with the IPCC. If we wait till 2050, we waited too long. So what can we do that will get buy-in from everybody? And as I mentioned in my book, carbon dioxide is just part of the problem. I mean, for example, I was born, raised, and educated in Canada. Canada is warming 5 times faster than the rest of the world on average. And we now know it's not just carbon dioxide. It's fundamentally black carbon soot. Black carbon soot from India and China is falling on the snow fields of Canada, melting that snow, and that's what's really responsible for the warming. I've got relatives in Canada that 30 years ago I would have 2 months of 35 below weather, and now they say zero is about as cold as it gets. I mean, we're seeing dramatic warming.
So how do we change the soot?
Okay. One of the things I'm seeing at this conference is a recognition coal is a problem. Coal not only releases greenhouse gases, it releases black carbon soot. And one of the things we could do immediately, instead of just saying we're going to get rid of all fossil fuels, that's going to take too long to find energy sources to replace those fossil fuels. But what if we did this? Say, we're going to have no more coal being used for fossil fuel. We're going to use natural gas instead. We got lots of natural gas. It's actually cheaper than the coal. It releases only half the greenhouse gases that coal does, and there's no black carbon soot. That would give us the fastest reduction in the global warming trend of anything we could do. You're still burning fossil fuels, but you're reducing immediately the greenhouse gases by a factor of two. Because with methane, you get both water and carbon dioxide, and the water typically falls out as precipitation.
So is your concern with the message of some of the climate activist side, Hugh, that where obviously renewables is where it's all at, that's just going to take too long and it's too inefficient a form of energy to see the kind of changes
I'm all
we
for
need?
Going there, but my whole point is it's going to take time.
Mm.
You're looking at probably 2 decades before renewables will actually be able to do the job. And one of the things I'm proposing is, okay, I agree that uranium nuclear should be off the table. There's just too many problems with uranium nuclear. However, uranium thorium is a whole different animal. With uranium thorium, it's impossible to make nuclear weapons out of it. It's impossible to have a meltdown at the reactor. And you get 300 times as much energy per ton of thorium than you do with uranium. So it's economically far more beneficial, but it's going to take time to scale up thorium where it could replace the fossil fuels. I think it could be done in a decade. So, you know, if we were today basically say replace coal with natural gas and now let's actually scale up thorium nuclear reaction. As I point out in my book, thorium nuclear reaction could actually potentially produce electricity for about half the price of the cheapest source now, which is water power. I mean, I have friends in Canada who drive their car, their electric car, all month for 55 cents of electricity. But the reason they can do that is their source of electricity is super cheap. It comes from water power. Now, that might work for Canada and Norway, but it's not going to work for most of the world. We're going to need another way to get cheap electricity.
Okay.
And thorium actually promises a source of electricity that's cheaper than water power.
That's really, really interesting, Hugh. I am being blinded by science right now, Antonio. I don't know about you, but I don't know how much you have to say on the specifics of these sort of types of solutions. But where do you take it? You know, in terms of these kinds of solutions, whereas what is typically being advocated is a kind of blanket ban on fossil fuels and a kind of moving entirely in the direction of renewables and so on.
Well, one of the things that we're asking this week as Parents for Future in Glasgow is to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Boris Johnson's currently talking about how we need to do that. We must make changes. We must lead by example. He's in the same breath. He's signing off on an oil field in Cambo. There are 40 new oil and gas projects in the pipeline happening between now and 2025. So when they talk about having to make these changes, we're not seeing the evidence. We're not seeing the fact that these are actually going to go ahead because it looks like that they will. On the other hand, I think to answer your question, I look at the much bigger perspective here, because essentially what we're trying to do is to use capitalism to solve all the problems that capitalism has caused. And I'm not bashing capitalism because I've got a dishwasher and I've got a washing machine, you know. And we live longer, healthier lives now. I've got sanitation. Capitalism has done a lot of good, but it's come at a great, great cost. And I think the danger with embracing solutions by all these, you know, new technologies, which obviously, Hugh, you know a lot more about than I do, is that we're not finding the humility in ourselves to see that we are living beyond our means. And if it was making us happier as a species, I would be on board. But the more we consume, the more miserable we get. Suicide rates have never been higher. I think America consumption in the States has gone up tenfold in the last 10 years, I think I read. You know, when human beings are as hungry for connection as they are right now, then they consume. We're in this mess because we are constantly, constantly trying to fill this hole within ourselves. That comes because we're such a disconnected people. I mean, we've got our phones and we've got our laptops and we're talking to each other now in three different countries, which is absolutely amazing. But our relationships are suffering. We're working harder than we've ever worked before, and half our jobs don't even, you know, they're just made up jobs. I mean, what did the pandemic teach us about what really matters? Nurses and teachers and bin men and that boy who delivers your pizza. Those are the people we need. And I suppose to answer your question, what is the solution? For me, it's less. It's all about degrowth. So I'm afraid I'm disagreeing with you there, Hugh. It's about really stripping back to what actually matters. And Actually, I think, and I'm put a lot of money on this. I'm sure, actually, that human beings would be a lot happier if they were focused on the right thing. So practically, that would look to me, and I know Extinction Rebellion have a reputation where you end up seeing us on the breakfast news shouting, as we do. We feel very angry and afraid, and I agree. I've been there too, and it's not effective. But essentially, like Greta says, if the house is on fire and everyone's walking past shopping and watching Love Island, it's frustrating and you want to wake people up. But it is alarmism, I agree, has to be the right kind. So the solution is, what can we do? For me, that looks like a 4-day working week instead of a 5-1. I don't know if you're aware, but in Japan recently, Microsoft, one of the Microsoft companies in Japan, suggested that all employees have every Friday off for 5 weeks. And you know what happened? They saved 23% on their energy costs, and they were 40% more productive because they were so much more motivated to work in the 4 days they're in the office, because they had so much leisure time to pursue creativity and connections and family time. So a 4-day working week, I think we should revolutionise our education system. Our children are not being taught actual anything they need to use. They're being made into little worker bees, you know, especially in the UK, and I imagine in the States as well. It's all about individualism, isn't it? Get your head down, sit down, be quiet, do what the teacher says, get your exams. You need to get a good job, then you can buy a nice house, a big car. And then you can remortgage, you get a bigger house and another car, and then until you die. And essentially, for me, that's not what life's about. That's not what Jesus told us to do. We're here to look after each other. For me, it's as simple as that, to live a life of service. And when we do that, the irony is, we feel much more fulfilled. When we're in community with each other, we don't need all this stuff. We don't need to consume. So a 4-day working week essentially would be a good start.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting Antonia's taken that tack, Hugh, because I think where she feels concerned, even though there may be potential solutions to the immediate problem, if you like, I think her concern seems to be that there's a danger that we're simply then just repeating the cycle at some level. We're just sort of saying, well, we've solved this particular problem, but it hasn't changed the way we actually think about the planet. We're just after more and more and more and more. We just want to make more money and raise standards of living to this degree and everything else. I mean, what's your take on that? Obviously, you take a very different approach to the kind of the practicalities of this, let's say, to Antonia.
Well, I mentioned a couple of examples that would enhance the world economy, get us off this greener warming of the planet. But most of what's in my book is what we can do to mitigate global warming and climate instability while we enhance the world's ecosystems. And I think, you know, Antonio brought up a good point here, is that we have all these people today living in crowded metropolitan cities and focused on a lifestyle that's actually not mentally healthy for them. But if we could actually improve the world's ecosystems, people are going to be more motivated to leave the cities and actually get in contact with nature. But to motivate them to get in contact with nature, we have to make nature better than what it is. And so one of the proposals I put in my book is there's actually a better way to manage the forests of our national parks than what we're doing right now. I cite research making the point that there's a certain time in the growth of trees where they pull 4 times as much greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere than the oldest, biggest trees in the forest. And the problem with leaving the biggest, oldest trees in the forest is that they die, and when they die, they release greenhouse gases. And therefore, we need to leave a few of those big old trees there because that's crucial for the ecosystem. But to harvest those trees before they start dying and decaying and replant them, don't clear cut. What you want to do is selectively harvest, replant them with trees that are going to be much faster growing, and make sure the tree density is optimal so that you don't get the bark beetles killing a third of the trees. The tourists aren't going to like it. The wildlife is not going to like it. But I've been to some of our national parks where a third of the trees are dead. And the reason why is we're not managing them well. And this could work with the Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we can really talk about trees unless we address the huge elephant, or I should say cow in the room, which is, of course, animal agriculture, because we are 60% of all mammals on Earth are cows and pigs and sheep. It's absolutely bonkers. And we're feeding ourselves in a wildly inefficient way. So if you're going to talk
about... Well, I think you'll be encouraged as you continue to read through Weathering Climate Change. I actually talk about that, how it would be to the economic benefit of people in the Amazon to stop cutting down the trees and trying to have ranches, because the soil is too poor for ranching. You might make money for 10 years, but now you've got a desert. We're actually in danger of transforming the Amazon Valley into a desert. They would actually make more money. The wildlife would be better off if we had them doing the right kind of lumbering harvesting. They would make more money than they would from ranching. They would have a much healthier Amazon forest and would pull way more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. You could actually double the amount of greenhouse gases being pulled out of the atmosphere from the Amazon forest if it was managed properly.
I suppose you're sort of seeing trees then as sort of like our sort of servants. It's their job. Their only existence is to really sort of suck in the damage we're creating. And I suppose I'm coming from it in from the perspective of wanting to cause, much less damage in the first place, so we don't have to rely on nature to sort of clear up our mess like this. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that and that's exactly what I'm advocating, is that we can actually work with nature as the Bible commands us to, so that it's more productive, it's better for the animals, it's better for us, it's better for the environment. These are win-win solutions.
On a former show, Antonio, we debated veganism, and I read out on the podcast the reply you gave, where you picked up a lot of the points, and you obviously see this issue as another very significant aspect to how we combat climate change. You think that the way that animal rearing to feed the world is going on is contributing significantly to that. Just to describe briefly what you think the impact is that's having globally, and I'll just be interested in Hugh coming back on whether he thinks the solution is to go vegan, as you obviously do, or not, because I think this is an interesting aspect of this whole debate.
Yeah, it is. I think, it's very unrealistic to imagine the whole world will go vegan, and it would be very wrong. I mean, I said to you before, I feel very privileged to be able to be vegan. It takes, I have the time and the money and the resources to be able to cook from scratch. So my children, enjoy a really, really healthy vegan diet because I've got the time to put into that. If you're a sort of single mum on benefits, working, two jobs, as many, many people in the UK are and throughout the world, it's not a possibility. It's just not affordable. In fact, being environmentally friendly is a very middle class thing as it is. And you can make people feel terrible for things that really aren't their fault. What you have to remember is the climate crisis hasn't been caused by you or me or Hugh. This has been caused by a very small group of rich men who wanted to get even richer. And essentially, the fossil fuel industry knew exactly what they were doing and covered it up. I think, before you're younger than me, Justin, before you were even born, they were studying the effects that their fossil fuels extraction would have. They were writing them down and they were thinking, that's bad. We'll go ahead anyway. And they didn't tell anyone. They've done this to our Earth and my children's future and your children's future without our consent. This is not our fault. We were working hard last night with mum's netters at Parents for Future. And a lot of people quite rightly are saying they feel really, chastised they're made to feel guilty. And I find that really heartbreaking. And one of the things I work on in my eco warrior sessions, when parents turn up saying they feel guilty, is you will absolutely not feel guilty when this session's over, because you didn't do this. You didn't cause it. This is not our fault, but it is very much our problem. And so in terms of veganism, it's a privilege. It's entirely, makes absolutely no mathematical sense to continue eating animals in the outrageous way that we do. But for me, it's a hugely ethical stance on anti-oppression worldwide. It's tied into anti-racism. It's tied into anti-exploitation. It's, for me, every 3 times a day, I'm just living out my values. And I feel incredibly lucky to be able to do that. But I would never insist anyone else went vegan, if they couldn't. I would never assume they would have the means to. And I don't think, it's fair to suggest the whole world goes vegan when, culturally, a lot of places, fishing industries and so, rely on eating animals. I find the whole idea of eating animals absolutely heartbreaking, but who am I to say? You know, actually, human beings have lived in harmony, as Hugh said. We've lived in harmony with nature for centuries. It's only really started to go wrong very recently. So I wouldn't say, no, the answer is complete veganism, but a reduction in meat and dairy is absolutely essential before we transition as a nation.
Be interested if you agree with that diagnosis that we need to change our dietary sort of intake as part of this way of tackling climate change, Hugh.
Yeah, I actually talk about that in Weathering Climate Change, is that we can change our diet in a way that would mitigate global warming. It would provide us with healthier meat. And you know, one example I give is, you know, what if we were to replace red meat from cows with red meat from ostriches? The red meat from ostriches has very little saturated fat, very little cholesterol. It's much healthier. It's actually the healthiest meat that you can eat. And it would release only 2% of the greenhouse gases that you would get from cows pound for pound. And there's actually the potential, if we scale it up sufficiently, that it would produce meat for about half the price of turkey, which currently is the cheapest meat that you can buy, at least here in America. I also make the point that if we can bring the whale population back to where it was 300 years ago, that whale population would actually suck up huge quantities of greenhouse gases, because whales defecate soluble iron on the surface of the ocean, which fertilizes the phytoplankton, which provides more food for the zooplankton, which provides more food for the fish, and ultimately it provides more food for the whales. So again, it's another example where everybody wins, because right now we're facing a shortage of fish from the oceans. We're over-consuming the oceans. Well, if we can bring the whale population back to where it was, that would restore the fish stocks. And if we can stop using cows as the main source of our meat, that again would be another big factor in reducing greenhouse gases. And it would be economic. The food would be cheaper. It would be healthier. We would all live longer. And I do agree with Antonio that, you know, my son was vegan for 2 years. He gave it up because it was too expensive and it took too much time. But what it did do is it dramatically reduced his consumption of meat. So he consumes a lot less meat than he did before he started that. So I'm with you on that. I think we can get by with a lot less meat. And I don't think we have to beat people over the head with it.
It doesn't work. Exactly, it doesn't. And it's one part of the solution, isn't it, our diets? How would you feel then, Hugh, about lab-based meat, you know, Impossible Burger and all the meats that are synthetic meats that are coming onto the market? Would that be comparable to ostrich?
Well, I'm a little concerned about some of these synthetic meats or meats that are based on soya, because they do have health consequences that we need to pay attention to. So, again, I put two chapters on unintended consequences in the book on purpose. Is that, you know, the problem I have with panicking is when people panic, they say, we got to do X, Y, and Z. We have to pass laws. We got to force people to do this. And then 3 years later, we regret it because it made the situation worse rather than better. So I'm encouraging the scientific community. I mean, I head up a team of 150 scholars from around the world in different scientific disciplines, saying the problem is we're trying to solve climate change where we only engage people that are atmospheric chemists. This is an interdisciplinary enterprise. We need to get the entire scientific community across all the scientific disciplines engaged in this, because if we only engage people from one scientific discipline, they're going to overlook the problem of, say, solar physics. So, you know, that's why I talk about we have to look at the changes that are going on in the sun.
I mean, they're scientists. They're not news presenters. They're not psychologists. Their job is to report the science. The IPC scientists, their job is to advise the government, policymakers. And actually, I think they've done a really good job. And actually, next year, there's going to be another report coming out saying, you know, this is the science. This is how social science predicts that populations will react. So, well, it remains to be seen. I actually think it's a very exciting time to be alive. I think that, sorry, here, Justin.
I'm just going to jump in and say we're bumping up against our final break, so we'll take a quick break and then we'll come back. It's been just a really interesting conversation from both of you today. Thank you very much, Antonia and Hugh. I want to finish by talking about The effect this is having on our young people, I've read some articles recently about sort of anxiety, depression, and you know, you mentioned the phrase eco warriors, Antonia, whether this is a significant thing that we need to be aware of as well, and we'll come back on that in just a moment's time. But you're listening to Unbelievable. We're talking about climate change. We'll be back in just a moment.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. If you're listening on podcast, would you consider rating and reviewing the Unbelievable podcast? Helps other people to discover the show. And if you enjoy the Unbelievable podcast, you'll probably enjoy Ask NT Write Anything, the other weekly show I host, and the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath. There's also loads of other great podcasts from Premier. You can find out more at premierchristianradio.com/podcasts. Max McLean was in touch after last week's show. We had a wonderful discussion with him on the new C.S. Lewis movie, The Most Reluctant Convert. He's confirmed that there is a US showings of the movie through to November the 18th. And in 14 cinemas in the UK as well on November the 7th. That's this weekend. So get in there quick. CSLewisMovie.com if you want to find out more. CSLewisMovie.com. Coming up later on tonight on The Profile, Nathan Blackaby is the CEO of the UK's Christian Vision for Men. It's an organisation aiming to introduce men to Jesus and the church to men. He'll be the guest of Emma Fowles on this week's Profile. That's in partnership with Premier Christianity magazine. You can catch it on its own Profile podcast as well. Speaking of men and the church, that's going to be the topic of an upcoming edition of Unbelievable in a few weeks' time. Is there a toxic masculinity problem in the church? I'll be joined by Kyle Thompson of Undaunted Life, a men's ministry, and Martin Saunders of Youthscape joining me to debate that. But next week here on Unbelievable, do we need to rethink the Quran and the Trinity is our discussion. Typically, Muslims, of course, say that the Quran completely rejects the concept of the Trinity. Well, my guests are Dr. Abdullah Galadari and Dr. Joshua Sijuade. Now, Islamic scholar Abdullah Galadari has been making waves with a new book that says that the Quran doesn't necessarily deny the divinity of Christ in the gospel, it just interprets it. And he engages with Christian scholar Joshua Sijuade, who's a specialist on Trinitarian theology and Islam, to discuss that book of his and whether we need to rethink what the Quran has to say about the Trinity. So that's next week's discussion here on Unbelievable. Let's get into the final part of this week's show. We've been talking about climate change. My guests are Hugh Ross and Antonia Godber. Hugh is the founder of Reasons to Believe. His book, Weathering Climate Change, it talks about the unusually long period of climate stability that has allowed humanity really to develop over the last 9,500 years. But he says, yes, climate change is accelerating over the last half a century or so. And his worry is actually about a new ice age that could create a mass extinction event. Now, Antonia, my other guest tonight, has been campaigning on climate change for a while. She says she is worried, actually, that some of the ways that it's put across, the alarmist ways, can actually cause people to stop listening altogether, and that's counterproductive. But we do need to do what we can in ways that are helpful for people to raise these issues. Parentsforfuture.org is a good place to go to find out more about what Antonia does. You've got, an online event this weekend, Antonia, as well, helping parents and children to think about climate. This is something I have noticed more and more recently, actually, is people, some articles about the fact that young people are getting quite anxious these days. And it's perhaps unsurprising because we're filling our news feeds all the time with dire, you know, sort of apocalyptic stories about everything's going to hell in a handbasket, basically. And I think that, combined with inevitably the sort of 24-hour news feed we live with anyway these days, is actually contributing to a real sense of anxiety among young people to the degree that, you know, it's causing mental health problems. Now, I'm guessing, you know, Antonia, you don't see that as a healthy way necessarily of engaging this issue, even if you do still want us to take the issue very seriously.
Yeah, as I said, it's a really tricky balance. My eldest is 12 and he's got a phone and he's not daft. You know, he's got access to the internet and I sort of restrict how much he reads, because you're absolutely right. Our brains are not hardwired for constant stream of bad news. And that's what our poor young people are faced with. They've really put this on the map, wouldn't you say? I mean, the youth strikers, Greta and all her amazing followers have really, you know, put the grown-ups to shame in a way by alerting us and in a really effective way, bringing this to adult attention. And that's why Parents for Future was formed, actually, by the amazing team led by my lovely friend Rowan, who basically quite rightly said, this isn't your responsibility, kids, this isn't your fault, and you should be enjoying your childhood. So Parents of Future, we operate as sort of a supportive embrace, if you like, around the youth, and we campaign with politicians and with corporations. We're in no way sort of blaming the layperson. We're really going for the select small group of people who are doing the damage, and we're running campaigns and increasing awareness and generally trying to engage people in the problem. But as for young people, I work with them also, and it's probably, Justin, my most heartbreaking job, because I work with sixth formers, GCSE students, and they are furious. They are rightly angry. When I was their age, you know, I was thinking about maybe buying my first car and maybe going traveling, getting married, having kids, and my future was very, very bright. But you ask your average 18-year-old, and I know you've got a teenage son, you ask your average teenager nowadays about the future, and they're glum, because it looks very bleak for them at the moment. And I know Hugh's agreeing with me. Unless we change and do something, and of course we're in disagreement maybe about what, but unless we make changes, their future looks desperately bleak. And I feel very defensive of them. I want to restrict the information, obviously, they read. And then I think it's about reframing things for them. So one of the things we're going to be talking about on Sunday is, you know, making sure when we talk about climate with young people, it's absolutely age appropriate. My 7-year-old daughter certainly doesn't need to know anything other than nature is wonderful and whales are amazing and trees speak to each other. And isn't that snail incredible? But then as they get older, we need to help them face this reality, but frame it so that we can empower them rather than making them feel disillusioned and powerless. So I don't know if you're aware, but Naomi Klein, one of my favourite authors, she says, you know, we're a part of a project of transformation that millions are already part of. So I always use that line with the young people. And I say, you know, it's not your fault and it's not your responsibility, and you're not on your own in this. Social justice, and that's what climate activism is essentially, it's a choir. We're all singing different tunes, and sometimes you need to take a break and a breath, but we're all in this together. You're not on your own. So I think that really helps young people. And then just getting the message across that there is a window, there is hope. But you know what's interesting about hope is that it can be quite dangerous. It can you know, enable us just to sit in our bedrooms and hope for the best. And Rebecca Solnit often talks about hope, and she says hope isn't a lottery ticket that you sit on the sofa clutching. It's an axe that you use to break down doors. And Joanna Macy, the amazing environmental activist, she's in her 90s now, author of Active Hope, she talks about hope being something you do. So I try and engage young people, not because it's their, you know, fault or even their responsibility, but because I want them to feel that they can be a part of building something, a better way of life, going back to that degrowth idea, a life with more being rather than doing. We're human beings, after all, rather than we're not human doings.
Yeah, yeah. Hugh, have you kind of noticed this phenomenon of the sort of anxiety or the kind of the sense of, I suppose, apocalyptic nature of the news feed that we get on climate change, kind of having that kind of paralyzing effect almost, and the mental health issues that are attendant with it?
No, I agree. As I engage young people, there just seems to be this idea that the future is bleak, and there's basically nothing we can do to stop the bleak prognosis. I mean, people refer to my book as the anti-Al Gore book. You know, he wrote a book called Inconvenient Truth. And basically I'm saying, well, we have a convenient truth. And with a convenient truth, we can actually give our young people hope. And not just young people, but the world's population. There is a way to deal with this problem that's not going to involve a huge amount of pain. And so we can offer people a hopeful solution to the climate crisis we're facing, one that is workable, one we can do relatively immediately, then I think our young people are not going to have this spirit of depression. But we got to get the word out. The word is there are win-win solutions. We don't have to have somebody win and somebody lose. Everybody can benefit. And again, I'm encouraging. We need to take this on with an interdisciplinary approach. That's my critique of the Al Gores of the world, is they're looking at only one or two scientific disciplines. And therefore, they're saying the only way out is to make these draconian economic sacrifices. And young people are saying, I either go with a sacrifice or the world is going to go up in a handbasket, as you said. There are solutions that are much more hopeful. So let's actually spread the word out there. There is a hopeful way out of this, a way that's going to benefit the poor, a way that's going to really improve our natural ecosystems, make them more pleasant, make it possible for us to actually go out there and enjoy them. Because I think part of the stress that young people are facing, they're in this high-tech, highly urbanized society where they don't have much contact with nature. And that's one thing I've learned as a Christian. When you lose contact with nature, it affects your mental well-being. But we are destroying the well-being of nature. There are ways that we can restore it and ways that would actually mitigate global warming, restabilize the climate, at least for another 1,000 years. I think we can buy at least 1,000 years if we do this appropriately. And in a way where everybody wins. So it's like, let's get on with it. And I don't think we need to change our economic system. We basically say, let's just let people realize the solutions that are out there and trust the fact that they're going to do what they know is best for themselves, their neighbors, and the ecosystems of the world.
Any final thoughts, Antonia, as we close this out?
Yeah, that's a very interesting concept. I suppose, economically speaking, I'm far more interested in circular economies and small and local rather than this global system that seems to be tearing us apart. We don't need our apples to be flown in from New Zealand. We need to remember the skills that we've lost because they're not being passed down from generation to generation. We need to be sharing tools in our neighbourhood and having street parties and making food for each other, growing food together and learning, passing those skills down onto our children, and in terms of economy, keeping it small and local and circular, where in that way, imagine if we managed to achieve that, we'd have far more than 1,000 years and we'd be able to carry on as humans have, because we would be learning, evolving from our mistakes and getting to a place of better understanding about what really matters, which is obviously community and loving one another.
Final thoughts from you, Hugh?
Well, again, I'm encouraged that people are actually focusing on this issue, because I think a bigger problem is people are just saying, hey, you know what? I don't care. We do need to care. We got children and grandchildren, and it's not hopeless. I think that's the main message I want to leave with people. There really is hope. And there are things we can do that will benefit all of humanity, especially the poor, that will benefit the wildlife system. I mean, what I put in my book are 40 different ways that we can mitigate global warming, stabilize the climate, and at the same time, boost the world economy and improve the world's ecosystems. Who wouldn't want that? I mean, in one sense, I think we can eliminate the political debate on this. This is something that every politician would sign on to. You know, whether you're taking a conservative perspective or a socialist perspective, it's like, hey, if these are the kinds of solutions out here, who's going to vote against us? Let's go for it.
Okay. It's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you both. Again, if you want more from Hugh, reasons.org is the place to go. I'll make sure there's a link to the book as well from today's show. If you want more from Antonia, parentsforfuture.org is a good place to go. And I'll make sure there's a link as well to that event that she's part of during COP26. Thank you very much, Antonia and Hugh, for being with me on the show today.
Absolutely.
You're welcome.
Lovely to talk to you both. Thank you.
Do send in your thoughts about this week's discussion. You can follow us on social media. At UnbelievableJB is my Twitter handle. If you want the show's Facebook presence, it's facebook.com/Premier unbelievable. If you want to get in touch about today's climate debate on email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I will say that my original plan was actually to bring in more of a climate change skeptic opposite Antonia. Now, for various reasons, that didn't happen. And I invited Hugh on. And I just found Hugh's perspective on this really fascinating. So in a way, it went right from the opposite end of a climate skeptic opposite Antonio to someone who perhaps is even more concerned in some ways about the kind of climate change, but obviously had a difference of view with Antonio on the ways to tackle it. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on all of that. Do get in touch. Thanks to all of those who've been in touch on all kinds of other issues across the last several weeks. Why don't we go to some of the many emails that came in on yoga. Now, we didn't get time for many of these last time, but Mike Shreve and Chris James joined me a couple of weeks ago, both former yoga practitioners, to debate whether Christianity and yoga can go together. Well, basically, they both said no, actually. There were some differences in their approach to it. But lots of people getting in touch with their own thoughts on yoga. Here's Josh, who says, I've been a Christian for nearly 20 years now. And for many of those years, I had an automatic dislike or disagreement with anything even hinting of the New Age. Well, about a year ago, I began doing yoga as part of a wider program of dealing with some unexplained chronic pain, which, in spite of prayer and fasting, would not go away. It has been extremely helpful. And while I can't attribute my healing solely to yoga, it's definitely been a contributing factor to the transformation of my physical and mental health. I put doing yoga in quotes because I never went to a class, I don't chant mantras, and I never say namaste, and I don't call myself a yogi. I just used YouTube videos to learn how to stretch and breathe. But that brings me to my point, which is a linguistic one. To most Westerners nowadays, that is exactly what doing yoga means: stretching, breathing, and isometric exercises. Given that, I was disappointed your guest didn't talk more about that and instead focused on doing yoga in the non-Western sense. Both your guests were in agreement that to whatever extent yoga means the religious, spiritual, or philosophical tradition from India, it's completely incompatible with Christianity. Well, that seems obvious to me. The one guest, Chris, then said that essentially physical stretching, without the religious or philosophical layer, isn't actually doing yoga. Well, fair enough, but that's just really semantics. The way I might say that eating Vegemite on toast isn't really eating breakfast. To others, it is, in fact. Your other guest, Mike, briefly mentioned that the poses and their names are dedicated to Hindu gods. And therein lies the danger of even doing only the physical side of yoga. However, I felt that contradicted his opening point from Corinthians about yoga practice being like meat offered to idols. So which is it? Do the poses have intrinsic spiritual dangers of unconsciously yoking oneself to Hindu demons? Or are they empty gestures that can be sanctified by prayer? I myself believe the latter, but I would have liked to hear the two guests hash that one out. Always enjoy the discussion, Justin. A perfect host as always. Listen to it myself while having a good stretch. Thanks, Josh. Leah in Minnesota is back in touch to say, thanks for providing a wonderful debate. Yoga has been a contested topic in my Christian walk, and I was excited to see that you provided a wonderful discussion between two Christians. I've practiced yoga from before being a Christian and after, but it was not until one of my pastors that I was working with expressed her extreme disgust and opinion that Christians should by no means practice yoga that I got interested in looking into the background of it. After much research, I came to the conclusion that just like other things like meditation, Christ can redeem the practice of yoga and use it for good. However, I must admit Mike made a good point when comparing the practice of yoga to Paul's discourse on eating meat sacrificed to idols in Romans. If my practicing yoga causes another to stumble, then it's not worth it. I'm not sure where I sit on the issue at the moment. Thanks for providing airtime for both sides of the subject. Thank you, Leah. This one from Chris Sound in Harrow says, I'm involved in healing and deliverance ministry. For your guest who said that after his deliverance, he found himself with a demonic spirit. What we do is when someone is delivered of any demonic spirit, we ask the Lord to fill that person with the Holy Spirit where the demonic spirit had left. And Christian Lomsdalen, who's president of the Norwegian Humanist Association, has been in touch too. He says, as most of your episodes, your latest episode was thought-provoking, interesting, and, well, just provoking. At the same time, it was quite recognisable. The debate about yoga and its religious roots does arise in Norway from time to time, especially when connected with school activities. For example, when PE teachers have pupils do yoga-ish and or meditative activities in class, or when RE teachers have similar sessions when working with Hinduism or Buddhism in their classes. For me, I have trouble seeing the religious aspects of regular gym yoga, although I have clearly seen religious elements to some yoga classes when I've joined my Christian wife to her yoga classes, as I sometimes do. It often depends on the teacher more than where the classes are performed, in my experience. That being said, as a longtime activist against religious activities in school, and as an active humanist, I do understand the parents that do not want their children to participate in what they consider an unwelcome religious activity. It is in many ways comparable to the tradition of school mass, which I've worked against for many years. One additional similarity is the ridicule that Christian parents are met with when they raise the issue regarding yoga, and when humanist, atheist, or Jehovah's Witness parents meet when they raise the issue of attending a school mass. In the Norwegian school system, there's an option in the Education Act that allows parents and pupils to opt out of school activities if they themselves consider these activities to be participation in another religion or life stance, or if they consider it to be against their life stance, religion, or philosophical stance. At the same time, the school must deny such petitions if this means the child will not comply with the learning requirements set by the curricula, and if it's not possible for the child to learn the same knowledge in another way in school. This is both problematic for the child's inclusion in the class environment and a safety valve for the families. Anyway, you say you've written something on the similarities of yoga and the school mass, or communion, I suppose, in Norwegian, that would be available with a Google Translate if interested. Thank you very much, Christian, for getting in touch about that show. Here's another one from Jim Brisson, who says, I am a retired from the US Army after 36 years, served as a chaplain and ordained in the Evangelical Free Church at first, and then went to the Episcopal Church in 2009. I broke my back on my last airborne operation in 2011. After a year of recovery, I was encouraged to try yoga in an attempt to regain some flexibility. It worked. I continued on. Soon my practice became a moving meditation of prayer. My intention for the class was found in the gifts of the Holy Spirit, love, joy, peace, etc. I spent the entire class breathing into my body one word. It was a beautiful prayer. I learned so much about the gifts and myself during the practice. It was also at the height of our most recent joint conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq. I was dealing with a lot of death in my ministry. Yoga helped me keep my focus on Jesus, restored my faith, and take care of myself in body and spirit. I became a yoga instructor with the noble thought of leading others to Christ from the front of the class. I oftentimes speak of prana as the breath of God, or healing, not only physically but spiritually as well. My noble attempts have found limited results as far as I'm aware. I'm sure some students have found some type of peace, but I'm not sure they've found Christ. In rethinking how much time and energy I'm putting in this endeavor, and perhaps investing in other modes of evangelism and teaching. The program on yoga was very enlightening. I may try to contact one or both of these men. Nevertheless, great program today. Thank you very much indeed, Jim. Great to hear from you. Thanks to all those who've been in touch with these interesting responses to the yoga program. And I think we've time just to squeeze in a few more emails in relation to our CRT, Critical Race Theory episode, debating woke Christianity, Owen Strahan and Jermaine Marshall. Lots and lots of response still coming in to this. This was Owen Strahan, who took the view that social justice, woke Christianity, CRT is a big threat to the Christian church. Jermaine Marshall was our other theologian, arguing that actually racism is a real problem, and that there's a bit of an overreaction to the whole CRT thing. Okay, Daniel said, I'm writing about the debate. I'm a second generation of Hispanic American in Texas, and I enjoyed the conversation. I mentioned I'm Hispanic to let you know that I don't have any quote-unquote skin in the game, if you'll pardon the pun. However, the debate left much to be desired with regards to the facts of systemic racism in the church. When Jermaine mentioned it does exist while giving some anecdotal evidence but not concrete evidence, there was no rebuttal from Owen. The labelling things as racist continued without any evidence or rebuttals. I wonder if you've heard of the Just Thinking podcast with Virgil Walker and Daryl Harrison. They speak extensively on the subject. It'd be great to bring on someone like them with Jermaine. Monique Dusen is another individual that speaks well about the subject. Thanks very, very much, Daniel. Good to hear from you. Hyde Phillips gets in touch to say, Jermaine seemed unwilling to engage with the challenge that wokeness carries with it, an unconditional judgment and culture of division. But Owen seemed unwilling to admit that there is a problem with systemic racism in America, and indeed the UK. And Hyde, I know you're from the UK. You say In any case, I found the lack of acknowledgement of the flaws in both worldviews characteristic of how this debate tends to go and makes bridging the gap between the two opposing voices much harder. For me, it's completely coherent to maintain a theological position that enables Christians to live into their total forgiveness, equality, and wholeness in Christ whilst being seriously called to stand up against systemic racism and other injustices and taking personal responsibility to pray for and play a part in breaking down the powers and principalities at work on a social and political level. Surely Christ's message was to enable us to know our lovedness and from that place seek to fight the battles of social justice. I wish there were more woke Christians who recognise the sometimes dangerously divisive undertones of its culture and more conservative Christians who recognise their own culture's denial of racism on a systemic level. Thanks as always. Thank you, Hyde. Here's an interesting one. From someone calling themselves Uncle Screwtape, which might give you the hint as to how to read this email. Dear Justin, just wanted to give some thoughts about the Owen Strand discussion. When Owen recounted the story of the pastor who preached a sermon calling people to reflect on white privilege and repent of racism and how much it insulted his friend, this reminded me of a similar situation in my own life. One day a travelling minister came and preached a message accusing the people in our congregation of adultery. I, a faithfully married man who has never touched another woman, accused of adultery. He justified it with some psychobabble about if I lusted after a woman. It's as if I committed adultery already in my heart. I was so insulted. But it got even worse. He went on to accuse us, tithing, faithful church members, of being no better than murderers, in danger of judgment simply because of anger issues. Well, this was when I knew that this woke left hippie nonsense was out of control. Something had to be done to stop it before it destroyed our nation and religion. So I immediately reported him to the religious authorities. I'm glad to hear I'm not the only true Christian patriot defending the integrity of our faith from the communist woke left hippie cult. Sincerely yours, Uncle Screwtape. Okay, I will leave the listener to interpret that email. Final one here. Chuck Halverson says, I've never felt compelled to comment on an episode on any podcast, but I could not hold back after listening to this one. As always, a truly compelling debate. I'm truly baffled by Owen Strand's denial of present-day systemic racism. As someone who claims to have studied CRT extensively, it seems to me he would have come across many examples of current systemic racism. One example, when black US soldiers returned from World War II, they were denied the Federal Housing Administration benefits granted to white soldiers. Coupled with banks practicing of redlining and artificially depressing property tax assessments, this forced black folk into homogenous neighborhoods with artificially low property values. US schools are funded with property taxes. Generations onward now, the US has black folks in economically depressed neighborhoods with subpar schools due to inadequate funding, and the result in many black families cannot accumulate wealth to pass on to their progeny the way many white families can. This is an injustice that continues and is not the result of a current law. Saying the New Testament does not compel the church to stand up for those folks and do something about that because those solutions might be called reparations is absurd. Dr. Strand's stance denying systemic racism came across as a hollow biblical justification to turn a blind eye to a problem that clearly exists, much like the biblical defenses of slavery, Jim Crow, and other reprehensible practices of years gone by. Thanks for hosting a conversation on such an important topic, says Chuck Halverson, who is a US Army soldier. Thank you very much, out in Alabama, Chuck. Many more that have come in, both for and against Owen Strand's perspective and Jermaine's. Thanks for all of those. We'll see if we can get some more in future episodes of the show. But that's about it for Unbelievable today. Glad to have you with me. You can email in your thoughts on today's show as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. For now, it's time for me to love you and leave you and tell you what's coming up same time next week. Do we need to rethink the Quran and the Trinity? Typically, Muslims say that the Quran completely rejects the concept of the Trinity. Well, interesting debate next week because my guests are Dr. Abdullah Galadari and Dr. Joshua Sijuade. Now, Abdullah is an Islamic scholar who's been making waves with a new book that says that the Quran doesn't necessarily deny the divinity of Christ. It just interprets the Gospels. Now, he's engaging with Christian scholar Joshua Sijuade, who's a specialist on Trinitarian theology and has often discussed it with Muslims. We're going to be asking, do we need to rethink what the Quran has to say about the Trinity? That's Unbelievable next Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio at 6 p.m. or wherever you are in the world via our podcast and video channel. Thanks for being with us and see you next time.